You're listening to Red Nation Online.
You're listening to the Paul James and Soccer Podcast. Commentary and analysis by Paul James, former Canadian soccer player, television analyst, coach, and member of the Canadian Soccer Hall of Fame.
Well, here we are with episode 20 of the Paul James on Soccer podcast, and it was another busy week for Toronto FC, with another trade, a big win down in Central America, and a back-and-forth league fixture against their former captain, Dwayne Di Rosario, and his team, DC United. Well, Paul, as you predicted, Toronto FC went down to Nicaragua and got the job done against Real Esteli, as they have booked a place in the group stage of the CONCACAF Champions League. In a match that suggested lawnmowers are still a rare luxury in that part of Central America, TFC did what they needed to do to get a result. Does the preliminary round victory suggest that Toronto is indeed making real progress in terms of moving things in the right direction as a franchise?
Not necessarily, Steve. I think that if they get through the group stages, then obviously that would be a better benchmark to see how far that they've come and that they would be going in the right direction. Let's be honest and let's be fair. But to get to this stage, they've had to play a team from Nicaragua. They've had to win the Canadian Championship, where there's only three other teams competing anyway. So it's decent. It's a good performance that they went in there in Nicaragua, and I would say very professional performance. You know, as a coach, one of the first things that you deal with when you go in is the environment. You know, whether it's the weather conditions, whether it's the size of the field, whether it's the state of the field. You have to be able to deal with the environment immediately without making excuses. And I think that I was impressed with that performance against Real Esteli was the fact that it was very professional. They dealt with it well. They were efficient and sensible with how they had it back. They went direct when they needed to. They didn't overindulge. I thought Terry Dumfield and Torsten Frings in the middle of the park were very good. And I thought it was a good performance, great couple of goals by Ryan Johnson. But it really was about dusting your hands at the end of that and saying, right, we were all business there, got the results, and then just get home. It was really very much that. But I would caution anyone to think that that is a sign that that the team is any better than what they've been, last year, because it was the same thing last year. They got through that particular round and then got knocked out in the group stages. You know, having said that, I actually believe that they're a better team. Probably the makings of the best team they've had so far. But hey, we'll talk about the DC United game in a minute.
One player who talked a lot about going down to Nicaragua and being professional was Ryan Johnson, who scored both goals in the second leg victory, and he's quickly becoming a favorite of mine. How do you like that trade with San Jose so far?
Yeah, so he's a really good athlete, you know, and he's quick and he's pacey. The first goal he scored clearly was out of nothing. And up until that point, they really didn't have any chances. Didn't look like they were going to necessarily score. They looked still in control, in my opinion, but that was out of nothing, and that was a game-breaking type goal. So, you know, he scored a few now, and when you get on a bit of a roll, it is an indication that you have a little bit of quality about you. And, you know, I think he seems to have a good attitude. He works hard. And he's a good athlete. So, and the fact that he's also, you know, whether it's fringe or involved with the Jamaica national team, I think that's that bodes well for him and for the club as well. So, you know, so far so good. But again, against DC United, we'll talk about in a minute. It's you know, he was is not as effective.
In advance of the match, many were calling for Aaron Vinter to start Stefan Fry for the crucial second leg, given that Milos Kosic had made a mistake leading to an away goal for Real Esteli in the home fixture. What did you make of Winter's decision to again go with Kosic?
Yeah, loved it. I thought it was a great decision, you know, with and it really is about, self-belief for Kostić to be able to go in there and put in a quality performance this time around. After it was an awful mistake, and that would have dwelled on him. But I thought, really, as a man manager of players and of situations, that was a really good decision. It's about getting back on the horse, but you can only get back on the horse straight away as the goalkeeper if you're given the chance. And I think the impact that has is from a credibility with the rest of the with the team. It really was about team building. It was about saying that we're going to be fair. He's a quality person, obviously. Kostić, he's a good goalkeeper. And those things do happen, and when they happen, there's nothing you can do. And for the easier decision would have been to play Stefan Fry, but then all the blame would have been on Kostić for one simple error. And I thought it was a great decision, and I was so happy for Kostić that he didn't repeat it. That there wasn't anything else that he did that you could question, and they got through the tie. So it was good. I thought it was a great bit of management and coaching, and I think that that gets respect from other players, I believe, when you do those kind of things.
Toronto's opponents in the group stage will be Taro FC of Panama, reigning Mexican champions Pumas UNAM, and FC Dallas, who you spoke very positively about in a recent podcast. What are your thoughts on the draw, and how do you like TFC's chances of advancing out of Group C in the CONCACAF Champions League?
Yeah, I don't like their chances of qualifying from that, quite frankly. But I love the draw. I think there's real quality there. And you just get more experience. When you look at now what Vince is doing, is trying to use some of the young Canadians, which I love. I mean, Ashton Morgan at left fullback, Daniil Henry, it looks a little bit better now. You've got Stinson coming in as well. So, it's about experience, the way I would look at it. I mean, they're still going to be in. They're obviously going to try and get through, and they're going to try and win. But I think it's about experience, and about exposing even the fans to the quality of play that, we have now in our country. Domestic professional soccer, it's pretty much the highest level, because Pumas from Mexico, again, will be an outstanding team. But very difficult to go in there. You're playing at altitude when you realistically, TFC can't focus on getting altitude training. There's not a lot that they can do. But when you get down there, it's so difficult to compete at that, plus the travel schedule. And then they have to go in and play Dallas. And Dallas, we saw Dallas are a quality team. But they're going to have to play them away, and that's going to be heat at a period of time when it's not going to be as hot here. So then you've got that climactic impact of how it's almost impossible to prepare to go in Dallas. It's going to be mid-90s against a quality team when you're just not going to be prepared for that by training in Toronto. So it's a very difficult draw, and the more or the longer that that TFC are involved or any of the Canadian clubs, you can begin to see and let's say Vancouver have pitched that they want to be one of the best soccer clubs in the world. Well, that's one almighty vision. I mean, it's great. It sounds great. But on the North American landscape, I mean, how difficult is it, to realistically get there, to get to the World Club Championships? I mean, you've got to have a superhuman effort and a real quality to be able to get there. Because to play the MLS season, play your Canadian club championship, to then go into CONCACAF and to get right through to the World Club Championships, boy oh boy, that takes something unrealistically on a nothing budget on a global scale. It's it's where Don Garber says that he wants to be competing at that, but really truly, I mean, let's call a spade a spade. It's a miracle, really. Real Salt Lake almost pulled off that miracle by getting there. And I know DC United got there, years ago, but that was at the infancy of the World Club Championships. But it's a minor miracle that you need under the circumstances with such a low budget to get to the World Club Championships. But nevertheless, the effort in getting there and the excitement in trying to get there is worth its weight in gold, I would say, for everybody involved. And even if TFC don't get through this group or don't you know, win their games. It's been on that roundabout that counts. I just hope that Don Garber and the MLS executives and the board of directors begin to see, begin to recognize and realize that without a substantial adjustment on what players' salaries are, you know, you cannot, you're not going to get there, in my opinion. You're really not going to get there. And that needs to be done. You know, when you look at players like Terry Dunfield making $60,000, and Terry's done well, I like Terry a lot, but he makes $60,000 or $65,000. How can that be as a 30-year-old in what is a Premier League in North America? And I know I've gone on a tangent there, but I think it really is relevant. You know, the question is, will TFC get through this group? If they do, I think that bodes really well for the trades that they've made, for the coaching, for the management. And it would be a great benchmark of where the future of the club is. I just don't see it right now. I think that it's going to be more of an experience step than anything.
In a back-and-forth and somewhat crazy league match on Saturday, Toronto FC drew 3-3 against DC United. Andy Iroh had probably the worst game of his professional career, and Dwayne Di Rosario scored a hat-trick for DC. What did you make of the match, and in particular, how Di Rosario performed against his former team?
Let's deal with the Di Rosario thing out of the gate. Unbelievable. Like, really, truly unbelievable. And, you know, credit where credit is due. He always seems to be able to put his money where his mouth is as far as his ability on the North American landscape at the professional level. You know, he often disappoints, it seems, at the international level when you play against real quality, but in the MLS, for whatever it is, he has got something special as far as being able to produce at the right moment. You know, I remember last year with when Preki was the coach, and Preki was moved out, and Di Rosario and Julian made comments that exposed them as being negative behind the scenes, which he got some flack for. So he was under real pressure, and I could tell in his body language and facial expressions when they went out against Houston, there was a resolve and determination with Dwayne. And you could tell, I mean, maybe other people wouldn't tell, but as a coach you can. And then he went out and against Houston and produced two unbelievable goals. You know, that free kick right at the end, I never forget it. It was unbelievable. And it just, it was typical of Dwayne Di Rosario in terms of his ability. But then the polar opposite, you know, is that then a couple of games later, or the next game, I can't remember where it was, but it was shortly after, you have the incident with the San Jose and the check signing imitation. You know, it's typical. That's how you see Dwayne Di Rosario. You know, he's a double-edged sword. He's his own worst enemy at times, and just doesn't, I suppose, get the management or get the direction from somebody that you know, steers him in the right way to deal with things off the field. But as far as quality on it, you know, at times he's just unbelievable. And yesterday was terrific. There's no doubt. It's you know, there is that side. I mean, it's like, wow, you're almost happy for him because it shows the quality, but it also shows that he's a great athlete. But he does have that edgy determination and resolve to, you know, to perform well at the right moments. If only he had the full package as far as his approach off the field as well.
Given how he played against Toronto on Saturday, have you in any way changed your opinion on Toronto's decision to trade Di Rosario?
No. No, I haven't that, and it's you know, I know some fans or some entourage would be calling TFC out on it, but again, you know, sometimes you have short memories and we forget. There's lots of lessons to be learned, I think, by a lot of people with Dwayne Di Rosario's situation, and you know, Dwayne's not going to listen to that. He's not going to listen to that comment because he feels that everything he does is right. But the reality is, if Dwayne was still in Toronto, it would all be about Dwayne, you know. And even irrespective of the salary issue, the salary issue is with De Guzman being paid $1.9 million, and Dwayne not being paid and being paid a third of that, like a mere fraction of that, and that exposes, you know, decisions by the club. Is that wrong compared? Is Di Rosario the better bet? Absolutely. But does that mean that Dwayne Di Rosario should have been a DP player? But that's all what it would be about. It's about Dwayne, you know, and not just even with the salary. When Dwayne goes into somewhere, and I think particularly his hometown, it was you can't get away with he can't get away with exposing the selfish nature that he has. In some ways, it works well for him, you know, with the production he has as a player, like in the environment yesterday. But overall, it's a negative when you're building a team, and particularly when you have a team that is in tough. You cannot undermine coaches all the time. You cannot have such strong opinions as a player. You know, players sometimes are the center of the universe with what they think and what they say. And it's only when they retire, what they don't realize is how short, in the whole scheme of things, in terms of your life, of how short your careers are. And there is another life after you've played. And when you stop playing, if you stay in the game, you slowly but surely begin to realize what it is to have a good attitude. Because if you begin to become a coach, then you deal with, if Dwayne becomes a coach, all of a sudden he's going to get exposed to bad attitudes, selfish attitudes, the wrong approach, players undermining a coach. It gives you time then to reflect about things and how you deal with them then. But when you're a player, you don't recognize those things. And I don't think Dwayne certainly doesn't. And, I think TFC have been strong with that. Now, we can talk about the trade, Steve, because I didn't talk about the rest of the game against DC United. You know, but the trade, you know, as somebody pointed out, is sort of works out now with what they've done with their players, that Iroh is one of the players that's been in that Dero trade in the end. And, you know, the game was absolutely unbelievable, really, when you think about it, in terms of incident, in terms of end-to-end at times, in terms of it being 10 against 11, the mistakes, a couple of great goals, the Dero plot. You know, really, truly, I mean, I really, really like MLS. I like Major League Soccer. I like watching other games outside the Canadian teams. You know, when you begin to watch games that are not involved with teams that you actually support, you know, it begins to say or speak volumes for what the league is. I think the league is exciting. That was typified with the DC United and Toronto FC game, in my opinion. It was lots of incident. And unfortunately for Iroh, there's going to be some... there's going to be some questions behind the scenes, I would say, because, you know, he clearly is a nice guy. I mean, all players are you know, you want to give them the benefit of the doubt. But I remember the first game that he played, and he looked a little bit clumsy and a little bit awkward. And you think, well, no, let's just let that go. Let's just that's just because he's just into a new club and he's just maybe fatigued. He hasn't played regular first-team football. But now, you know, half a dozen games along the way, you begin to see that maybe the quality is not there. There's no way, Steve, that you can make those kind of mistakes, give away a penalty down in Nicaragua, give away another penalty, and make a really clumsy mistake as a centre-back. I mean, this is for whatever the salary budgets are that I just talked about, is that this is big-time football. This is exposure, and everybody's on the line here. When you go out and play, you cannot make those mistakes, period. If you repeat them, it's only a matter of time before you're going to be gone. And I think if that's the case, that would be too bad. I mean, this is where management, and my question now would be with Paul Mariner. Some people, you know, I'm not overly sold with Paul Mariner, I have to say. You know, with some of the comments he's made right out of the gate at the beginning when he came into the club and were praising, you know, the academy and some of the people at the academy. And I'm thinking, well, how do you know that? You've just got here in the city of Toronto, yet you're making such strong comments. In my opinion, it wasn't intelligent for Paul Mariner to be doing that. You need to be careful. You need to do a good assessment that takes 6 months. But now, if Iroh doesn't work out, then somebody's accountable for that, because it impacts a lot of people. It impacts the people you've traded. It impacts Iroh himself. I mean, you really, truly have a responsibility as a coach or a manager that when you go out and get players, or you and you play players, you've got to be fair to everybody, including that player. Because if they don't fit in, you shouldn't expose them. Because now all it does is cause a little bit disharmony, but really causes a lack of confidence and some ridicule along the way. that and harshness in terms of the criticism, which is fine. This is the world we live in now, which is the media exposure is phenomenal that these players have to deal with. So that's fine. That's the world that it is. But you really truly have a responsibility as a coach and a manager to get those things right. You know, Paul Mariner, if he's gone out and scouted Iroh and made the determination, yes, he's absolutely the quality, then he needs to be accountable if he turns out to not be. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to be the case, but really, after that particular game and after six games, you have to question the quality that he seems to not be at the quality that you require for this level. And again, it's at the back. I mean, TFC looked good going forward and they're scoring goals. But I don't know at any level, but particularly when it's complete parity across the board, you need to get your stuff sorted out defensively first and foremost. And from the get-go, from day one to now 5 years down the road, we still, as a team, TFC, have not got themselves sorted out. And I've been a big critic of Jason DeVos recently. But I'm telling you, I'm listening to Jason DeVos on the comments, and I can feel in Jason's voice that there's a passion with how he talks about defensive mistakes. And the reason is because Jason was a centre back, and there's no way on earth that if Jason was playing that those mistakes would be made. You know, Jason is a real quality when it comes to defending, and I just don't get it. I just don't get how coaches at that level and first team managers don't get that right. That's a coaching issue. It's not just about the selection of Iroh, whoever they've made, the Garcias down the road. It's also a coaching issue. It's not just about the defenders at the back. For me, it's the center of the park. So now I'm going to disagree strongly with Jason DeVos. And for anybody else that makes the comment on Julian de Guzman about being a defensive midfield player, there's no way, in my opinion. He went to Europe and he's been... He didn't have the impact as an attacking midfielder because the quality he was up against. So what they've done is, with Julian over there, they fitted in him somewhere where he could play because he was under contract. And he ended up being in some kind of defensive position. But he was never groomed as a young player to be defending 1v1. If you put Julian in a 40 by 30 yard grid and go 1v1 against players, you would get every idea about how good this player was defensively. And he's okay, but he's not at the level. It's not his natural instinct to be a defensive midfield player in how a defensive midfield player needs to be. There's no doubt about that, in my opinion. And yet he's a schemer, meaning he can get the ball off the back four and he can play short passes and so forth. But in terms of the quality it requires to be a defensive midfield player, I just don't see it. And until you've coached, I suppose, you maybe don't get that. But, it's sort of annoying for me to hear that people keep pitching at it, at Julian as being a defensive midfield player, when game in, game out, he proves to me that he isn't a defensive midfield player. You know, it's a little bit frustrating, that, for me, I must admit. But that's how I thought. Overall, the game was a quality game in terms of incident. TFC going 11 against 10, and they tied 3-3. I think that's huge question marks on maybe the coaching of how they managed that particular game. And still the quality level, as opposed to the Nicaragua, when you asked about this show the turning point, it really does question about still where they're at. There's a lot of work to be done, particularly, again, on that defensive side.
Julian de Guzman did score his first goal for Toronto FC on Saturday on an admittedly controversial play. How do you think Julian did against DC, and do you think that goal could be something that could spur him on to a run of better form for Toronto in the remainder of the season?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully. I mean, he wasn't on long, and it was, again, 11 versus 10, big fields. DC would have been fatigued a little bit, so he had good space. I thought he was good. I thought he was efficient. I mean, there was controversy with the goal, but that's not Julian's fault. I mean, it was diabolical refereeing there, really, truly. But, hey, that's the game. Some, you win some, you lose some. But it was a great goal by Julian. Bad goalkeeper, by the way, but you know, I mean, good for Julian. I mean, this is not about hammering Julian as far as it's an opinion as far as where he fits as a player. For me, I see things differently from other people, I suppose. But as far as on the ball, he was better, and he needs to be better. I mean, really, because I thought Terry Dunfield has been good. You know, in terms of the full package, defending, attacking, he seems to be a better fit than Julian right now. But that's up to Julian to prove otherwise. But good for him to score a goal. I can see he was happy about that, and he was all around not bad for sure. He was good on the ball. But time will tell when you play 11 versus 11, and again he's in that defensive role. See, the problem they have as well is Torsten Frings. Torsten Frings is terrific, there's no doubt. But again, I think I said last week, you'd have to be a blind man to see that he doesn't have the pace, and he's not over time. He's 34, so he can be 35. He's just not going to have the legs. Those legs are going to go real quick. So you need him beside them, like really truly. You need some quality athletes in beside them who can really, defend, to almost do a role. I mean, that's what, people talk about. I correct me if I'm wrong here, Steve, but Toronto have conceded more goals than anyone in the league.
That's correct.
That's what I'm assuming. And there's a reason for that, and it's definitely the player personnel at the back. I think it's a coaching issue now as well, because it's repetitive. You have to work on the defensive shape and the defending 1v1s. All the players should be absolutely, well-groomed and well-oiled, well-oiled machine. They should be at the back, but they look anything but it. But it's also the midfield. If you don't have your midfield with an out-and-out role player, somebody that you actually don't notice too much on the ball, because all they're doing is concentrating and stopping that ebb and flow when you're in transition. And it's not Julian's game. Torsten Frings can do it to a certain extent, but he doesn't have the legs in the hot climate. And that is as big a part of the problem as it is at the player personnel at the back. You know, there's three things there. There's the player personnel at the back. There's the coaching that I think is going is being poor for the defensive shape. And then in the center of the park, to have an out-and-out role player that's a defensive player.
Well, it was also another week and another trade for Toronto FC, with the team acquiring Eric Avila from FC Dallas in exchange for Maicon Santos. What are your thoughts on the trade and on Avila's first start for Toronto against DC United?
Yeah, like the trades, based on what I've seen. Santos was his sell-by date was up, and again, it's really as a league, and especially with Aaron Binter. This is another thing I like about Aaron Binter. He wastes no time. You come in, you perform, you show them what you've got, and if it ain't good enough, then you move them out. And it's the harsh reality. And again, with the salaries being so poor, it's it just seems to be even more cutting when they make those decisions. But life is life. Santos was okay in Toronto, but not going to be good for the long term, so they move him out. I think that's fine. They get in return a player from a team that's played quite a bit, and a team that's of real quality, so technically those players are going to be well groomed, and I like him. Avila, I think his name is, Steve. But what I saw the other day, I mean, he's going to be that attacking midfield player off the front players. And he really is like that playmaker, so when you're attacking playmaker, let's say the ball goes at his feet, they really have three basic choices initially when they're on the ball. This is how I judge an attacking playmaker. So he gets the ball. Is somebody in a better position than him? And it seemed to me that whenever there was somebody in a better position, he released the ball immediately, which is good. If the answer to that question when the ball goes to his feet is that there's nobody in a better position, then you look to shoot. Can you shoot, or can you dribble and attack the space? And, those are sort of fundamental, basic things of a playmaker in that attacking third. Is there a player in a better position? Yes, he'll play it. Can you shoot? Yes, he'll shoot. Or can you dribble and attack and penetrate into space? And I thought, based on those three things, he did a great job. And when any of those weren't available, then he just played things simple. He was very comfortable. He found space well. And I thought, not perfect and not a perfect game, but I thought there were glimpses there that in what an attacking midfielder should be in terms of those three things. I thought he was good. I thought, as a 23-year-old, that looks like a real positive trait.
You've spoken a lot on previous podcasts about the roles that you believe the MLS and the CIS can play in terms of developing players for our Canadian national teams. Red Nation Online writer Kamal Hylton recently wrote an interesting article entitled, "Where Does the CSL Fit in the Canadian Soccer Hierarchy?" I'm wondering if you might take a few minutes to give us your thoughts on the importance of the CSL and the role it can play overall in Canadian soccer.
Okay, well, let me first of all talk about the CIS just very quickly, because, a lot of people focus on the university. I know you're going to talk about it in a minute in the next question as far as the U.S. system. But the other thing about the collegiate programs and why we need to improve our system in Canada, it's not just about player development, and it's about player opportunity. And when you have player opportunity, you have player motivation. And when you have player motivation, you have player commitment. And when you have player commitment, you can get player commitment probably 8, 9, 10, 11 years of age to do the kind of training that everybody seems to talk about that is missing and needs to be done. That's the purpose, that to me is the main purpose of why I say that we need to improve our CIS system. That's what happens in the NCAA. In the NCAA, I mean, you have players across the United States paying $600, $700, $800 to go to a residential soccer camp by just entrepreneurial people that run soccer camp businesses or universities that run soccer camps as an 18-year-old. As an 18-year-old, players will pay a lot of money to go just to a basic one-week soccer camp, and they do it is because the motivation to go to university and get scholarships and play at the collegiate level is significantly high. We don't have that in Canada. And if you have that in Canada, it's not just about player development, it's about coach development. If you had full-time across the board in the CIS, that would be able to allow coaches to develop, that would allow the motivation and opportunity for players to play at a nationally exposed level. So that, I just want to touch base on that because I know I've talked over the last couple of weeks about coaches that, the Bob Bradleys, the Shales Hyman, the Bruce Arenas, the Siggy Smiths that have all applied their trade in the collegiate system. That's where they've learned. That's where they've learned their trade. The CIA, the CSL, I mean, first of all, at any league that exists at that level requires an amazing amount of work and dedication by a lot of people, and whether it's the owners of the clubs, whether it's the players themselves, whether it's the administration, the organization and the vision. I think, it's a legitimate league that has done well, that has progressed. It's allowed the academy teams from Montreal and TFC to be involved. I think that's very positive. And I think, it needs to be recognized. As I said earlier, when I was referring to Dwayne DeRosario, at times, when you play as center of the universe, you don't realize what the contributions are from everybody else that allows you to be able to play. And the CSL, I think, is good, but there's some limitations, and particularly if we don't have a vision to be able to see what opportunities can come from the CSL. The biggest negative for it for me is the fact that majority of players would be in their mid-20s and already off the roundabout from being professional footballers, from ever being able to go and play and compete in the MLS, really realistically being able to go to Europe. And as a result of that, so they're basically full-time employees somewhere in the corporate world or somewhere out there in the environment. And then they use the CSL as a part-time soccer initiative for them to keep playing and to maybe make a few expenses or a little bit of money. So that's fine. That's the model. But when you have that, you have limitations when it comes to development of your players. In other words, if you've done a full-time day and you're turning up to train at night, it's very difficult. And I've been along to some of the training sessions over the years. I mean, not recently, but over the years. And they're not particularly of high quality. You can only demand so much from your players. You can only say so much about technical work. You can only do so much as far as physical work. The mental, trying to get them all bought in. There's limitations because players just at the end of the day, in that kind of environment, it's too easy for players to say, oh, well, I just don't want to do that. And so from a development model, it isn't great, I have to say that. But from an organizational, from a commitment of the people that are involved in it, and again, it's great for Montreal Impact and for Toronto FC to be involved in that, because their young players play against senior players in still something that's competitive. Because at the same time, when I talk about these older players, they have experience. They have experience and they have age on their side, the physical capacity to produce a level that would be helpful and assist the younger players from the MLS teams. But in terms of the overall development model, I'm not overly sold on it. I have to say that. The fact that Montreal is top of the league, you know, in some ways you could say that's good. That's a good reflection on Montreal, and it is. They've done a good job with their academy team, so even though their first team hasn't done quite so well, there's some positive signs for them with their younger players. But at the same time, you don't want that to be. You don't want them or TFC to be the ceiling on the CSL. You want the CSL to be good, and where the academy teams are really having to fight hard. And what it seems Montreal are doing this year to actually get to the top. They really shouldn't be at the top if the CSL is at the level that it needs to be. So you know, there's some limitations, but no shadow of a doubt, they deserve a lot of respect for what they're doing.
In a related question sent in by a Paul James on Soccer listener, Edson Arantes asks the following. Hi, Paul. I enjoy your podcasts. With so few Canadians making the jump to MLS, there's been some chatter about the need for a Canada Division 2 league. I understand the CSA is presently studying the idea. Do you think a Canadian Division 2 league, similar to the old CSL, would help the country develop a better and deeper pool of players? Is such a league feasible? And is there any truth to the rumor that you are conducting the study?
No, I'm definitely not conducting the study. Would a Division II Canadian League across the country help in terms of the development of players? Absolutely. There's no question about it. It would. But is it feasible? I would say very unlikely. And again, it comes down to money and motivation of players. So we're talking about, I mean, just look at this. You've got MLS. You've got Toronto FC, and you have players on Toronto FC that are Canadians that are making $65,000 and less. You know, you tell me, in this current landscape, in this current generation, in this current world, what the motivation of your average soccer player, as a young player growing up, that how great that motivation is going to be to, in the end, make that kind of money, which is very poor for the level that you're playing. And that is the pinnacle right now of North America. So the problem is that if you're going to run a Division II Canadian League across the country, what are you going to pay your athletes? And if you don't pay, and it's not a good enough enticement for them, then they're not going to be motivated. So again, it comes to the opportunity, the motivation, the commitment level. If they don't have that motivation, it's too easy for them to bail out. It's too easy for them to go into other things. So it's a real problem, because the business model of anything outside what the MLS is now, because they're the benchmark. They're the benchmark to what people want to watch in terms of quality. Anything below that is not going to attract, in this climate right now, this is not Europe, this is not Latin America, this is Canada. Is there anything below that, whether it's the PDL? PDL teams do well here in Canada, in my opinion, as opposed to the CSL. It's a much better development model, in my opinion, because it takes care of a niche and a need for players that are in universities to continue to have something more year-round by taking care of their summers at a competitive level. But the reality is not many people go out to watch those games. So if you have a Division II league, and you want to do it across the country, you have major, major expense problems. And the revenues coming in, I just don't see where they're going to come in. What is realistic is what Edmonton have done this year. And that, to me, is the Division II level. It's and the more teams that you get like Edmonton, you got Edmonton and Ottawa, Montreal and Vancouver were at that level for many years and sustained themselves. But that's what you need. And again, hats go up to Edmonton for being able to produce what they've produced, but with Canadian players. And I think that does bode well for the opportunity of Canadian players. But there's always going to be that ceiling, in my opinion, until we find a way, and MLS finds a way of increasing the salary budget, because the motivation in this day and age for players is significant. And I know people say, well, you know, people would or players should give their right arm to play at that level, and they should be appreciative of that. Well, you know, I've actually lived that, and many players have lived that in Canada when the old Canadian Soccer League, and you spend years and years chasing the dream, making no money, and at the end of it, you know, you begin to question what you did. And so, you know, it's how you do that, how in Canada you build a model to develop Canadian players at a realistic opportunity in terms of what they can do to sustain themselves from a living perspective. And I just can't see the business model for a Division II league across the country being able to do that. The PDL I like. I think the CSL you know, caters to a certain niche of the market. If it's just the academy teams or providing them, you know, good competition. What I would like to see that happen, Steve, you know, when we talk about this Canadian Open League, because again, if we talk about opportunity and you talk about motivation, then you get the commitment from players. I think the time for an investigation would be on the Canadian Open Cup. You know, you have four teams. You're going to have Ottawa, and Ottawa come in will be five teams. I think there has to be a way of integrating the semi-professional leagues or semi-professional amateur or PDL, whatever you want to call it, at what level. But I think there has to be a way to now integrate those teams into the Canadian Open Cup. I don't know the logistics. I don't know the policies and the rules of what would have to take place, but it should be investigated. So, for example, if potentially a CSL team or a semi-professional team from around the country could be in a preliminary competition and there were three spots to make the tournament an eight-team tournament, and you have some kind of draw where teams can be similar to the FA Cup that you have in England, where semi-professional teams from outside that, you know, first four leagues, the Premiership, Championship, Division One, and Division Two, but then you have all the semi-professional leagues, they all get an opportunity to be able to compete and play. If you had that in place in Canada, that would automatically shift the motivation of players playing in the CSL, because they know the carrot at the end of it in terms of some money, but particularly status, would be significant in terms of the motivation for them to train, to be committed, because there's an opportunity to be exposed, but an opportunity to actually win something and get exposure significant. I mean, that would be a dream for them at that stage. I think when you open those kind of areas, you're talking about, to me, the opportunity. And when you have opportunity, you have motivation. When you have motivation, you have the commitment to players. That's something I would consider. And to again directly answer the listener there, I just don't see a Division II being feasible. It would 100% help the development of Canadian players, but it's the business model. The business model to me should be that North American Soccer League and the MLS. That to me is it, and an improvement on the CIS.
Continuing on the topic of developing young players, The Washington Post recently ran an interesting article entitled "Soccer Prospect Jalen Robinson Highlights a Debate About Elite Players." The basic gist of the story centered on the fact that Robinson, who is generally considered one of the top young players in the U.S., has rebuffed offers from some big clubs in Europe and instead decided to go the U.S. college route via a four-year scholarship to Wake Forest, with some people questioning whether or not he would be better off developing at a world-class club in Europe. What did you make of the article, Paul, and the debate contained within it?
Yes, I think it's a very interesting debate. There's no doubt about that. I thought the article was very good. Thomas Rongen made some points, I think a couple that I agreed with, a couple that I didn't. But the one he was saying is that, you know, when you talk about university or going to the professional level, you're really dealing with a very small percentage of players, of the elite players, that the national programs, the World Cup programs, the youth team programs in the United States and Canada, you would want your players really to be developed at the highest level. And clearly, if a player can go to Europe and be with a Premiership team as opposed to going to university and college, that's ideally what they would want. So, you know, I'm fine with that. But then he was critical of the university system, saying it's only a 3 or 4 month season. Well, that is not true. It's true in the fact that the NCAA season is 3 or 4 months, but it doesn't mean that's all you do during the year. First of all, there's the spring season. Second of all, there's the access to being able to train on a physical level yourself. And then the PDL league is, you know, it's, and this is what's so great about the United States and the innovation of people, and for them as organizations down there, is to develop something like the PDL league to cater to something that they need as far as their development goes. So there was that in-between period where university players don't do anything over the summer that was as competitive as it needed to be, so they developed the PDL league. You know, it's terrific. So, you know, there's avenues now realistically for players to compete at the collegiate level and still get good development to be able to go on and be good national team players for the United States or for Canada, and to be able to compete at the professional level. I mean, they go hand in hand, obviously. So, you know, I think it's probably in this day and age the exception to the rule that Jalen is doing on this. He's clearly an elite player, one of the top players of his age group. So the majority of those players these days do go straight into professional football. But, you know, for me, I'm fine with them choosing to go to the collegiate level as well. They get international experience throughout their college environment because they still go away on camps. They still go play international games. So they do get reasonable development, and they can still be involved in PDL during the summers or with some of the MLS clubs. I would say it's a very interesting article. It really is thought-provoking. At the end of the day, the sporting model in the United States has always been through the collegiate system. And there's some real upsides with that as far as getting an education in this day and age. Without an education, you limit yourselves. You know, the only antidote, it appears these days, from a good education or a development in a trade is to be rich. You know, that's the only antidote to not having it. If you don't have that, if you don't have an education, you don't have money, then you're going to struggle in society. So, and I think particularly when players are very vulnerable, you know, we talk about Terry Dumfield and other players that are making minimal money in the MLS. You know, you spend years and years sacrificing along those lines. Well, anyone else at the same age that's in the corporate world and moves up the corporate ladder and moves up the salary ladder where they can take care of their interests, you know, there are huge sacrifices that players make. And if they've done it as well without an education, it really is the fallback. And I think that the parents of Jalen Robinson there are giving him, you know, some solid advice, because in that family, education is very important. And same with Teal Bunbury. You look at Teal Bunbury. He went to university. And at least if you start it, you know, Casey Keller, I remember going to university and got a couple of years under his belt and then did correspondence. However they do it, you know, and it doesn't always mean that, you know, some people are not caught out to go to university, but, you know, some can get trades or get college diplomas. But really it's a positive. I think it's a real positive of the North American environment that. And it's also amazing when you hear American players speak. You know, you can tell where their upbringing is as far as the academic model goes, because they are well thought out. I think in many areas they're very humble. So, yeah, interesting, very interesting from a development perspective. But you're not going to get me on down the path of the collegiate system not being valuable as far as the development goes. I think there's many avenues where it's very, very positive.
This is episode 20 of the Paul James on Soccer podcast, and thus far, I've thrown a diverse list of items related to Canadian soccer at you. I'd like to end this episode of the Paul James on Soccer podcast by doing something a little different and getting your aesthetic viewpoint on the new Montreal Impact MLS logo, which the club unveiled on Saturday.
Well, Steve, I'm not particularly artistic, I have to say that, but love the logo. I think it's a good idea for Montreal to do you know, to rebrand something as far as their organization goes. So what better way to do it with a logo? I think it's quite chic. It's quite simple and, you know, sort of classy in a way. I think Montreal are very much like that. You know, it's just a personal preference, but I love their colors as well. The key for them, though, is to get a new coach in place. I'm not sure it's going to be Nick DeSantis. I think he's an interim right now, and knowing what he's done as a technical person and director of the organization, the soccer part of it, I would say that's a busy enough job as it is. So it'd be interesting to see what they do about coaching. You know, Nick Dasovic is out there. You've got Tater Thordarson, who has by now great experience, and certainly with Tater Thordarson, he would bring that discipline, you know, part that's always a question mark with Montreal. You know, they tend to be very flexible with some players that maybe have a history of immaturity or not the best attitudes. So maybe they're feeling the consequences, the negative consequences of being that flexible. Tater Thordarson would be a good addition as far as that goes, very professional. And then Nick Dasovic, maybe it's a good opportunity for Nick. So be interested to see what they do as far as that goes. Their academy team is the shining light for them right now, which has been a difficult season. But I think when you have your academy team doing well, that bodes well for what you're doing with the organization. They're doing some good things right, and I loved the logo. And it'd be great to have them in the league next year.
If you have questions that you'd like Paul to address, please send your email to pauljames@rednationonline.ca.